Well, in recognition of National Stroke Month, we're going to be talking about strokes today, how to prevent them, how to recognize them, what to do if you have one or have had one. Larry Mueller here. Great to have you along today on the Ideas Network, and great to welcome back our two guests, Dr. Luke Bradbury, vascular neurologist with the UW Hospitals and Clinics, medical director of their stroke program. Dr. Bradbury, welcome back. Good to have you with us. Thanks very much.
It's great to be here.
And also great to have back Chris Welly, who is a registered nurse, coordinates the UW Comprehensive Stroke Program. She helped organize Wisconsin's first stroke camp for survivors and loved ones. Chris Welly, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you, Larry.
You may have some questions about strokes or experiences to share. I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at ideas@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page title, The Larry Mueller Show. We hear about silent strokes these days, and maybe you could talk about, Dr. Bradbury, what is a silent stroke? And if it's silent, how do you know if you had one?
Yeah, that's exactly it. So silent strokes, and there's probably, you know, it's hard to estimate how many there are. Some studies would suggest even, you know, over 10 million a year in America of a silent stroke, which is where there is interruption of blood flow to a part of the brain that causes a stroke. And it's, if it's a silent stroke, that's generally probably a very small area of the brain, but it doesn't cause symptoms, and that's what makes it silent, so to speak. And so the patient or the person who has this silent stroke wouldn't actually know that it was going on. We'll see these sometimes in my clinic. I'll get referrals because someone had an MRI, for example, of their brain for one
reason
unrelated, exactly,
yeah.
And they'll show on that scan that there has been an old silent stroke, and I'll ask the patient, did you have these symptoms or those symptoms, and they'll usually tell me, no, I didn't have any. So it's something that is, you know, kind of difficult for us to address because it's unheard of, but if we could identify patients who are having these a little bit better, we'd be able to address their stroke risk factors earlier, because it's sort of similar to a TIA or a transient ischemic attack, where someone will have brief interruption of blood flow to a part of the brain that is then restored, and the symptoms go away and there's no damage left. But we think of that as a warning sign for stroke. So we can look at the risk factors that patient may have, whether it's carotid artery narrowing in their neck or a heart problem or something like that. And then we can try and either adjust medications or sometimes even surgery, whatever it takes to reduce that risk of stroke. And so if we can find a way of identifying silent stroke someday, that would be helpful in preventing that bigger stroke down the road.
Yeah, so they're not as dangerous, immediately as dangerous, I guess, as a full-blown stroke, but something you really want to...
If we could know about it. But that's the challenge. You know, if there's no symptoms, how would we find that out?
And so, if you've had one, are you more likely to have another one?
Anyone who's had any stroke or TIA is more likely to have another stroke. And that's really because there are those risk factors out there that may not be addressed as aggressively as possible. And so they're at a higher risk of having another stroke.
Chris Welly, what are those risk factors for strokes?
Smoking is...
the big one, I suppose.
Yeah. And one that's easy, I mean, relatively easy to take care of, as opposed to your age. You can't really do much about that. But high blood pressure, diabetes are the big ones. Those are the three biggest ones. And high cholesterol in your blood, so you'd need a test for that. Those are the
main ones, yeah. Well, we already have callers online. By the way, you can join in, too, with your question or comment at 1-800-642-1234. Give a call. Raymond in Madison, we'll just go to you. Thank you for calling.
Hi, how you doing?
Great. Appreciate the call. What's on your mind?
Well, I've had a history. Last July, I had a mini stroke that affected my vision. The only thing I noticed was I couldn't focus watching TV, put on a different pair of reading glasses. I laid down, took a four-hour nap, got up and felt like didn't feel very well. Drove home from Janesville to Madison, went to the eye doctor because I promised to go to the eye doctor. They looked at my eyes. The eyes were fine. Then I did a Fields test. And the woman told me that I had a mini stroke to get to the doctor immediately. So did everything, went to the hospital, had a CAT scan, all that. And then last Friday, I'm working, and I started talking, and nothing came out the way that I had wanted it to. I was talking gibberish. went to the hospital, went to the ER, but apparently the time had too much time had passed since I had it, and there's nothing they could really do. But I do have an appointment with the stroke clinic. I want to know, how much is the impact of my high triglycerides have to do with that? I mean, I've been trying to work with my doctors for 5 years to get them lowered, and they're still like 500.
Oh. Mm-hmm. So that's your story is a great one that maybe we could talk a little bit about stroke awareness in general and what to do, Raymond, because I think you have I've seen a lot of patients that are in your exact situation in my clinic and also in the hospital. And so, you know, first, you know, to talk about stroke, I think it's so important to always remember that time is so important and that, you know, there's a saying we have where, you know, time is brain. And that means that the sooner you can get attention to the stroke, the more likely we are to be able to do something, either restore blood flow or give you a medicine or treat it such that we can rescue some brain that might be at risk of having a stroke. But, you know, Raymond, the symptoms that you had of vision loss due to a stroke, and without having reviewed your chart or seen your scans, I'm assuming there was a stroke in the back part of your brain where the vision is processed. That's usually where the visual field cuts are found by the ophthalmologists or eye doctors. And so a lot of patients don't realize that that's a stroke. And so we have this this mnemonic we go by called BFAST. And those letters will stand for different symptoms that if you experience them, you really need to call 911 and go to the hospital right away. And they stand for balance is the B. Eyes is the E. So that's vision changes. You can have a double vision or visual field loss. And then the FAST stands for face, so it's drooping or face weakness. Arms is the A, so weakness in your arms or asymmetry, you know, suddenly one arm is heavier than the other. And then S stands for speech, and that can be both slurring your words, not getting the words out correctly, or not being able to you know, easily get the words out. You know what you want to say, but you can't get them out or understand what's being said to you, and that sounds kind of like some of the other symptoms you were having. And then T stands again for time, so you've got to call 911 right away. And so as part of stroke awareness, we want to get that out there. But, you know, the other sort of part of your story to talk about is when you go to the hospital, there's a lot of workup that's done. And so we'll need to, you know, obviously do like you had a CAT scan, maybe a brain MRI if that's possible. We'll need to look at the blood vessels to make sure that there aren't any narrowings or carotid buildup. And your problem with the high triglycerides plays into that. A very common cause of stroke is narrowing in the carotid arteries in the neck. And that's where cholesterol, triglyceride problems, high blood pressure, smoking, a lot of the risk factors we spoke about earlier, can lead to narrowing of those arteries. And that puts people at a much higher risk of stroke. And so if you haven't had those arteries looked at already with either an ultrasound or a scan that looks at the vessels in your neck and head, that's very important because that is potentially something that you might need an operation for or maybe just medication adjustments. But to finally address the question you had about triglycerides, those are very difficult to treat. We know we have a lot of medicines called the statins that can help address what we call the bad cholesterol, the LDL. But triglycerides are harder to treat. There are some medicines that maybe go, try and address that a little bit. But really, you know, diet changes, exercise, those are the kind of lifestyle modifications that we like people to make to try and get their triglyceride levels down. But it's harder to treat than cholesterol, unfortunately. So.
Yeah.
There's a lot of times a genetic component too. Mm-hmm. And
to the whole thing, yeah. Raymond, good luck, and thank you so much. Thank you so much for calling. Yeah, go ahead.
Matter of fact, I do have an appointment with the stroke clinic on the 30th of this month, so I'll probably see one of you two there.
Great, absolutely.
That's great. Also, you should know that even though you have high blood pressure, if we treat it, your risk goes down. Like, treating all those things will decrease your risks.
So. Yeah, thanks so much. I was thinking about my own triglycerides, which are pretty good now, and partly the result of doing 3-mile jog in the morning every morning. Well, 5 days a week I usually try and do it. And over the last year, my doctor's really happy with me.
That's great. There's some, you know, we try and figure out what lifestyle modifications are the best. And so we have these guidelines, for secondary stroke prevention, but I think also fit very well for primary stroke prevention. And that's, you know, how much physical activity should one get is a very common question that I'll hear about in clinic, in the hospital. And the guidelines suggest exactly what you're doing, you know, maybe 3-4 times a week at least of getting sort of moderate to, you know, high intensity aerobic exercise seems to go a long way in helping prevent strokes. And, you know, it's good for the rest of you, too. You know, good for your heart and your muscles and joints and everything else.
So. Dropped 30 pounds, too, over the last year or so.
That's excellent.
that was, I guess, a pretty good result. You have a telestroke program. And before we go back to the phones, just treated its 1,000th patient. Tell us about that program.
So the telestroke program here at the University of Wisconsin, what it allows us to do is sort of reach out to smaller, more rural hospitals often, and sometimes even bigger city hospitals, like we have an agreement with Swedish American in Rockford, where we can do it. And basically where there isn't a stroke specialist, a vascular neurologist, who is there to be able to see and examine patients, we can provide that service. And the way it works is if someone shows up to an emergency department that we have a telestroke agreement with, the emergency room doctors there will evaluate the patient and determine that they may be having a stroke and they're in that acute phase where something can be done. And they'll call us, and then we can actually log on to our computers and using a webcam and, you know, both video and audio, we can see and evaluate the patient. So we can do like an exam, see what their weakness is like, check their language, their vision, and things like that, and help them make a decision about whether or not to give, for example, a clot-busting medicine called TPA, or do they need to fly here on their helicopter to get an emergency endovascular treatment, which is where they go and try and pull a blood clot out, or you know, maybe we can also determine that it's not a stroke, which is also a very helpful thing we could do and avoid unnecessary treatments and pretty hopefully provide some relief to the patient and their family that they're not having a stroke. And so it allows us to get sort of a visual examination of the patient, get a good history, and also kind of counsel a little bit so we can talk to them about options and what we might want to do. And it really, the studies that have been done on telestroke show that it improves both the time to get emergency treatment medications and also the number of people who actually get them. And some of the hospitals we have, for example, you know, in Platteville, is a very small hospital. It's a kind of a standalone emergency department. They just don't have the resources to keep a vascular neurologist on call 24 hours a day, and so we can provide that care. And we just opened up an agreement now with Wisconsin Rapids, Aspirus up there, so that we can also do the same thing for their hospital. And, you know, not all these, even if they're having a small stroke, it doesn't mean that they need to come all the way to Madison, but they can still get that opinion from a vascular neurologist. So we're going to add more hospitals as we can and as our capacity increases, and hopefully help more people across Wisconsin and northern Iowa and Illinois and elsewhere get the treatment that they need in that acute phase.
That's really cool.
It's so nice for people in a small town to be able to have the expertise of a large city right at their doorstep. So that.
And here's right now we've got 1,000 people that got some help that might not have gotten that help.
That's right. That's right.
I think it's a great program. Jackie in Eagle, Wisconsin, has something for us. Hi, Jackie. Thank you for calling.
Hi, good morning, and thank you for taking my call. I have a basic question. If you suspect you've had a stroke, you come from a family that has had many strokes, can that be detected with MRA testing, or do you have to have an MRI?
Maybe talk about the difference, MRA and MRI first,
sure.
Dr. Bradbury.
Yeah, absolutely. So an MRI scan stands for magnetic resonance imaging. These are the scanners where they've gotten stronger and stronger over the years, and they're very safe. There's no radiation involved, although if you have claustrophobia, it's a very narrow, you know, sort of tube to get put into. But what an MRI scan can do is give us very good pictures of the brain itself, and this is where we're finding a lot of these silent strokes, because we can see very well both new and old changes in the brain that might be related to stroke, bleeding, and other problems like that. An MRA stands for a magnetic resonance angiogram, and that's where they use the same scanner, the same magnet setup, but they use it in such a way to look at the blood vessels. So it looks at the arteries, and often in the head and the neck, we can look at both of those. And so usually if someone's getting a stroke scan, you know, stroke evaluation, they'll get an MRI to look at the brain, and they'll also get an MR angiogram to look at the head and the neck blood vessels to, again, sort of determine what the risk factors might be for stroke. So they usually go hand in hand. Now, sometimes what people will get is a sort of a screening scan with an MRI to look for strokes or other problems in the brain, and they won't necessarily always get an MR angiogram. So you may get one or the other, but generally they're done together if you're looking for strokes and causes of strokes and things like that.
But if you go to the hospital in the immediate period, they will usually just do a CT scan originally to so that they'll know if you can get a clot buster or not.
Wow.
So it's not all about the scan.
Yeah.
Okay, I just wanted to know because my husband has had an episode. I'm not going to go into the complete description. But his neurologist, who he saw for the first time, ordered an MRI and insurance refused it.
That's very frustrating. Something I deal with quite often. I find myself writing a lot of letters to insurance companies trying to justify why that scan is necessary. And I wish that was an easier problem to solve, but you know, I would just keep pushing and see if they can't get that approved. Sometimes it takes, you know, a phone call from what we call a peer-to-peer review where your neurologist may need to talk with the doctor at the insurance company to get that approval done. But they can be very helpful in certain, you know, situations and give us a lot of information and ideally, again, you know, save the insurance company money by preventing the next big stroke. And so, you know, that can be something that I hope they can appeal and get approved if it's necessary.
Thank you so very much for all the information. I think I know what to do going forward.
All right. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Chris Welle, registered nurse, coordinates the UW's comprehensive stroke program and has helped organize the first stroke camp for survivors and loved ones, and Dr. Luke Bradbury, vascular neurologist with the UW Hospitals and Clinics, medical director of their stroke program. I'm Larry Mueller. Michelle Johnson, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network. Taking a look at strokes today and silent strokes with our two guests, Dr. Luke Bradbury and Chris Welle from the University of Wisconsin. Wonderful to have them with us. Questions, comments, give a call at 1-800-642-1234. Email at ideas@wpr.org or post on the Larry Mueller Show Facebook page. Diane from Fort Atkinson wonders, if she or anyone should take a baby aspirin as a preventive measure. I've heard it's good to take one after a stroke, but what about before a stroke?
So aspirin is what we call an antiplatelet agent. It affects there's these sticky cells in your blood called platelets that help with blood clotting. You need them in case you get a cut. They'll stick on to the wound and prevent bleeding. But, you know, they also, taking a daily aspirin will help inhibit those platelets and allow blood to flow through narrow arteries, for example, or, you know, kind of those plaques we were talking about earlier, carotid buildup, can help it flow through there. And so we found that aspirin is very helpful in stroke prevention. Now, not everyone needs to take an aspirin. So it really depends, again, on what your risk factors are. If you have a history of smoking and high blood pressure, diabetes, those are very good, you know, patients who might need to take a daily aspirin in order to prevent a stroke. Certainly, if you've had a stroke or a TIA, that's very important to probably be taking one of those medications, unless you have, for example, atrial fibrillation, which is an irregular heartbeat. In that case, you need a more aggressive blood thinning medication. There's several of those on the market now. And you may not want to take aspirin because then your bleeding risk may go up without any true benefit. So it's something to talk about with your doctor, understand what your risk factors are, and if you do need to take it, you know, take it every day. There is, sometimes when we use the word stroke, though, we also include bleeding type strokes or hemorrhagic strokes, and those are very different than the blood clot strokes. In those settings, sometimes patients, we definitely don't want them taking aspirin because it, again, increases the risk of bleeding. So talk with your doctor, understand your risk factors, but it can be a very good, safe way to prevent strokes and heart attacks.
Also, the bleeding is accentuated by over-the-counter things, so people shouldn't take a lot of ibuprofen. Ginkgo biloba also increases your rate of bleeding. There are a lot of other things, so make sure you talk about all the drugs.
All the drugs, you bet. David in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, David. Thank you for calling.
Thank you so much for your program, Larry. And my question is twofold. First one, for an elderly person who maybe is neglectful with taking their insulin, if they're diabetic, I think that dramatically increases the risk of stroke. What if that person, say, had a minor stroke and continues to be neglectful in taking one's insulin? Does that really ratchet things up? What's the general sense there? And then the other question, just based on the last question you had, is taking a baby aspirin on a daily basis perhaps an alternative to going on to statins if you're a male person of a certain age? So thanks so much for your expertise.
Thanks for calling.
These are two great questions. The problem with diabetes, so diabetes clearly increases the risk of stroke. We know that a lot of people, especially, you know, have diabetes for many years before it's even diagnosed, and the damage that can be done with the blood vessels both going to the brain and the heart is, can be dangerous. And so we always try and make treating the diabetes, getting those blood sugars down, and reducing the hemoglobin A1C is the test that's often done to sort of monitor blood sugar levels over an average of 3 months. But, you know, the problem with stroke literature right now is that even with better control of diabetes and treatment like, we recommend and from the endocrinologist, it hasn't been shown to be as helpful as we would like in reducing the stroke risk. And so that's something going forward we need better treatments for. Now, I don't think that's an excuse not to be as aggressive with treating diabetes. It doesn't mean that, you can sort of slack off and not take your medicines as your, doctor would want you to. So I think it's still very important to treat diabetes, but unfortunately with the stroke literature, we haven't seen people who treat their diabetes, incredibly well do much better than those who don't as far as stroke prevention. Now, the second question about aspirin and statins is those are actually two very important medications that are working in different ways. And if you need to take them both, it's important to take them both. So the aspirin, again, acts against those sticky cells in the blood, the platelets, and your statin medicines will act on the cholesterol levels via mechanisms in the liver. Statins also seem to have other effects. They reduce inflammation. They seem to stabilize the blood vessel walls and help prevent strokes, and maybe in other ways in addition to lowering cholesterol. But if you need them both, it's important to take them both because they're acting in very different ways at trying to get the same problem of strokes. And so take them both if you need to.
One of the more serious issues is if you're an insulin dependent diabetic, you really need to take your insulin as it's ordered.
Yeah.
And you can get into a lot of trouble if you're not taking it right. So if you have a mom or a grandma who has a little difficulty with that, it's real important to make sure that you can come up with some kind of a system, maybe draw up the things ahead of time, put them in the fridge, label them so that they do take them as ordered.
You know, I was in just sort of reading about strokes for the show. Stroke is the fourth leading killer of American women, which kind of struck me. And actually, women suffer more strokes and more disabling strokes than men. Why would that be the case?
I think there's a lot of reasons for it. And one of the biggest may be the historical sort of, approach that, heart disease, for example, and stroke prevention is more of a man problem. And so a lot of the prevention and some of the work for primary prevention of those things, was focused on men. I think that the other thing to remember is that strokes happen, your age is another a non-modifiable risk of stroke, and often women are living longer than men, and so that may be that they put some at higher risk of stroke. Men are dying earlier of other diseases. So I think there's a variety of reasons for that, but I think at the end of the day, really the message is that, women, need to be very they need to go see their doctors and get treated for things like high blood pressure and diabetes and all the other very common causes of stroke that we have, just as do men. So it's an important message to get out.
I know women present, just thinking about heart attacks for a minute, they present symptoms differently in some cases than men. Is that true of strokes, or are strokes pretty much the same if it's a male or a female?
I wouldn't say that there's a huge difference between men and women in their stroke presentations. Often weakness, numbness, language problems, speaking, vision changes, like we talked about earlier with the caller. Those are all pretty common, amongst both. And so I don't know that there's a big difference. And actually, Chris was just reminding me, too, about women. Estrogen does, play a role in stroke risk. So, for example, young women who are taking birth control pills that contain estrogen and smoking at the same time, we know that their risk of stroke goes up pretty significantly compared to those who are not, taking those or smoking. So that, there is some component that estrogen will play in it.
Let's, David, again, thank you for your call. I want to give Rosie and Ashland a chance to join us. Rosie, hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, I have a comment and kind of a warning. My husband was in the nursing home, and the nursing staff determined that he had had a stroke and wanted to know if we wanted anything done or let him go, and it turned out it was just low blood sugar.
Oh, so a misdiagnosis. Is that a, does that happen very, Dr. Bradbury, comment on that?
Absolutely. And this is something that we spend a lot of time educating our residents and medical students and nurses and colleagues about. You know, one of the things we have to differentiate early on when we're seeing a patient with symptoms that are worrisome for a stroke is it what we call a stroke mimic? And stroke mimics, low blood sugar, like the caller just talked about, is a very common one. People with low blood sugar may have signs and symptoms that look very much like a stroke. And determining whether it's a stroke or not is something that we need to often do in the hospital with a scan, a very careful neurological exam, and things like that. But, you know, blood pressure, like, for example, if having, you know, profoundly low blood pressure, people who have had a seizure, after their seizure may often look like they've had a stroke because one side of their body may be weaker than the other. So there are several things. Complicated migraines is another one that can happen. People have migraine syndromes that can, again, look like a stroke. And so trying to sort that out often takes an expert, you know, a good neurological exam, maybe a scan, some blood tests, for example, you know, to see what the blood sugar is. So that's a very common thing that we do see, and one of the things we try and sort out. Of the stroke, we have a system at UW and hospitals all over have we call stroke alerts. So if someone has symptoms that's worrisome for a stroke, they'll call out the stroke alert, and it'll call the appropriate doctors and nurses and techs to come and evaluate the patient and determine. About half of all the stroke alerts at UW turn out not to be a stroke. And so we call more, and whether it's a stroke mimic or some other, you know, neurological problem that the patient is having is not uncommon at all. We see that quite frequently.
It's real important for people in the community, though, to not try and make that determination themselves, but to come to the hospital. We're more than happy to tell you you haven't had a stroke. It's one of the best things get to do.
That you get to do. I would believe that for sure. Well, Rosie, I thank you for bringing that up. I appreciate it very much. It gave us a chance to comment on that whole area. We'll turn to some other folks as well. And Dan in Eau Claire, I'm sorry, Don in Eau Claire, it's your turn.
Yes, hi. I'm 94 at the present. Next month I'll be 94 and a half. Cognitively, I consider myself in real good shape. As of next month, it'll be 2 years since I had a GI bleed, and at that time I developed atrial fib. And I've had atrial fib since then, which has been well controlled with metoprolol. And I've been on warfarin ever since with real good control. I watch my weight. It's been pretty steady for probably the... I do have a diabetic family history, not in parents, but in grandparents and two aunts on the same side of the family. But anyway, my question is, how long should I continue preventative measures? I don't plan to become a pagan and overdo it, eating or anything like that. I do watch my weight, but I'm limited in how much I can exercise, and I wonder if there's anything else I can do, because the longer I live, I guess the longer I can expect to live.
Yeah.
So atrial fibrillation, what you're talking about with the irregular heartbeat that you take the Coumadin for and the metoprolol, is the most common cause of stroke in older people in America right now. And that's why identifying it and getting on the medications that you're taking is so important. You know, I think that, you know, given your situation, you're 94 you know, you're taking some medicines that are very helpful in stroke prevention but may also carry a significant risk for side effects and other problems. It really comes down to, you know, continuing to talk with your doctor about what sort of quality of life you want to have and what kind of things you can do to stay healthy, but also know that, you know, maybe there is such a thing as too aggressive treatment in certain areas. And so I think it sounds like you're doing everything right, that you're taking the excellent medicines and staying active and eating well. And you know, that's also going to be good for your cognitive health going forward.
Sure.
It reminds me, there is a study that just came out recently from the University of Wisconsin. It was done by our neurosurgery department here. Dr. Robert Dempsey, the chairman there, kind of led the study, looking at the carotid narrowing that some people have and certain ultrasound testing that can be done to determine how stable that narrowing is. And people with unstable narrowing tend to have worsening cognition going forward. Their memory testing got worse as time went on. And so, you know, trying to understand why that happens and, to hear about patients like you that are doing so well at 94 is really, you know, something we need to do a better job of doing in the medical field of you know, trying to keep people not only, on the right medicines, but also having a good quality of life, because that's really what it all comes down to.
Yeah.
So, keeping your cognition sharp and being active and enjoying your days is really the best you can do. So I think you should expect a good, life going forward here.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
We're really lucky, too. We have... We have one of the NIH StrokeNet sites, and there are only 25 hubs in the United States. So we're the regional coordinating center for research for hospitals all through the area, and there are 200 hospitals nationwide in that group of researchers.
So. Yeah, a lot of good research going on.
Yeah, great. And
so if we come up with something, we'll let you know.
Good for you, Don, and thanks a lot for calling. I appreciate your call very much. I want to give Connie and Portage a chance to join in. Connie, hi. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. I never worried about what my doctor ordered for me. He ordered cholesterol medication, which was Crestor, is the only one I could take. And I take the generic form of that. And then my triglycerides were high, so he ordered fenofibrate. And I take those together. And it didn't bother me. But my pharmacist said something to me about you shouldn't be taking those together. Now, I'm worried about it, so I wondered what you thought.
I have several patients that take those together if they have high triglycerides that don't come down well with medications right. like Crestor and diet changes and things like that. So mm-hmm. I think like any medication that you take, any combination of medicines, it's always good to know what the risks are and what the side effects might be. But it's also important to remember that not every patient will experience every side effect that's listed for those medications. So it's important to watch it, make sure your doctor knows about the combination there and that there might be some interference. But, I think with close monitoring of your both your labs and also just, telling us how well you're doing, it's important to keep up with it. But I think I do have several patients taking those together. You do have to be careful with all medicines, including those. So.
Well, I don't know what the side effects would be, but I don't seem to have any.
I think the main side effect that we worry about with the statin medicines is muscle breakdown and muscle soreness. It can cause breakdown of the cells in some of the bigger muscles. That's why a lot of people will start complaining of muscle pain in their thighs or in their shoulders. Now, a lot of times we'll have to stop that. Maybe that's often, I don't know if you tried other cholesterol medicines and that's what you experienced?
I have tried others and they bothered me. Crestor has never bothered me, but then I have osteoarthritis and I've ached all my life. You just go with the flow with that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, and so I think if Crestor is working well, that's really important because again, the studies would suggest that it does a very good job at stroke and heart attack prevention, and those triglycerides. Again, maybe we will have a better drug someday of getting those triglycerides down, but fenofibrate's one that's commonly used.
Well, so. It seems like the combination has brought them down quite a ways. So
that's great.
Good for you.
That's great. Mm-hmm.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling, Connie. Appreciate your call. You know, before we get away from time here, Chris, I know I've mentioned that you got the first stroke camp going. Could you talk a little bit, and we talked about this a bit on the last time you were on, but it bears repeating. Tell us about the stroke camp and what goes on.
I'd be happy to, Larry. It's stroke camp. It's called Retreat and Refresh Stroke Camp, and it's actually for stroke survivors and their families. So they come for a weekend, and we do. They get to relax, socialize with other people. There's a little bit of education. This year, we're going to be at Green Lake again, which is is a beautiful
place.
It's really inexpensive, and there are scholarships available for people who can't afford it. And if you go to strokecamp.org, you can find that. You can sign up for that. We still have some slots available for people who have not experienced it yet. But people want to come back year after year. They just love it.
And what are the dates for that?
It's the 15th through the 18th of September. 15th through the 17th,
The 17th, okay. Nice time of the year to be at Green Lake.
Oh, yes, it is. We do some fishing. We do some trips. We do crafts. We do boat rides, just all kinds of things that people don't normally get to do because they don't have enough resources, and it's just a blast.
Well, that sounds wonderful. As we continue our discussion here, we're starting to run a little bit out of time, but there's still a little bit of time here. Reducing... there are a couple of things I wanted to talk about. Anything new in the way of treatment or preventive care? And then what about reducing the risk of stroke? We've talked about it, but I think it always bears repeating. Mm-hmm.
You know, new in treatment, we're still very excited about what this, we call endovascular treatment. So in the mid-90s, a drug came out called TPA, a medication where we give it in the vein over the course of an hour, and that tries to break up the blood clot to allow restoration of blood flow. Between the mid-90s until just about, you know, 3 or 4 years ago, we really didn't have any other great approved treatments for stroke. But now we have these very amazing tools where it's similar to when people have a narrowing in the arteries in their heart where they have a stent put in, where the people can, my specialist surgeons and radiologists can put a small catheter, a little tube into the arteries that goes up into the brain and actually pull out the blood clot if we can identify it early enough. And that will immediately restore blood flow. And actually, the studies that have been done on this, which came out several years ago, were very positive. So they saved a lot of death and disability in the patients that got treated. And so that treatment can happen in those studies was done within 6 hours. One of the big trials that we're participating in at UW is to actually see, well, can we extend that time window? Can we look at patients who come in the 6 to 16-hour time window, and if their scans look good, that the brain hasn't already died from the stroke, can we actually use those tools to open up the artery, restore blood flow, and prevent more disability and death? And so that's very exciting. I hope that this study shows that we can use what we'll call an imaging window. We'll get a bunch of CT scans rather than a time window to help reduce the risk of death and disability from stroke. So that's very exciting, and we hope that that is positive. For stroke prevention, you know, we found over the years that the medicines, we talked about the aspirin, the cholesterol medicines, good blood pressure control is so important as well. Treating diabetes, we hope someday will show actually data that it does help with strokes. We've been doing a much better job. When you look at, there was some study that looked at the stroke recurrence rate in studies that were done back in the 1960s, and it was almost 9 or 10% in a lot of cases. Now that's less than 2%, and probably even now less than 1% for a lot of people. So we've done a very good job over the many decades now of really reducing the stroke recurrence rate. And so prevention is very advanced now. So.
We're really good at the medicines, I think, but where we could use more help is in diet and exercise, because you can't just take a pill for that. Mm-hmm. And so...
So get some physical, eat healthy, get some physical activity, how much physical?
About 30 minutes, a couple times a week, 3 or 4 times a week. Yeah. And then real quick for diet stuff, the Mediterranean diet, is just, if you look that up and you kind of follow that, that's a very good diet to be on for stroke prevention.
The fewer things that don't look like food, if you can't recognize it as growing outside, don't eat it. But exercise, the American Heart Association recommends 30 minutes, 5 days a week, and an hour of vigorous. But you can break that up any way you like. As Dr. Bradbury said, you can do it in 3 days, you can do it in 4 days, but you should try and get that 150 minutes in.
Makes good sense. Well, it's always a pleasure to have you folks come and visit with us, and I hope you'll be back and do it again.
Thanks very much.
Really enjoyed the conversation. Dr. Luke Bradbury, vascular neurologist with the UW Hospitals and Clinics, medical director of the stroke program there. Chris Welly, registered nurse, coordinates the UW Comprehensive Stroke Program, and has been very involved and helped organize Stroke Camp for survivors and loved ones. And again, where do people go to get that information about Stroke Camp?
Strokecamp.org is the best place.
Okay.
And you can, but there is a phone number you can call. It's 309-688-5450.
309, give that to me again.
309-688-5450.
5450. We'll get that up on our Facebook page.
That's great.
Thank you both
so much.
Very much appreciate it. We will talk with them again, Dr. Luke Bradbury and Chris Welly from the University of Wisconsin. Great to have them with us today to talk about strokes. We're going to switch gears and talk with you about the arts. According to the latest survey, local nonprofits arts programs generate about $500 million worth of annually to the state of Wisconsin. We'll find out some more about that. And hopefully you'll be telling us about some summer arts events that you have in your community. That next here on the Ideas Network.